Shalom and welcome again to another edition of Seekers of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Address, and I greatly appreciate you being with us. With these podcasts, we hope to explore some of the issues that touch us, our families, and our congregations in light of the revolution in longevity that is reshaping our Jewish world. And we appreciate your support. You can follow us on our Facebook page, Jewish Sacred Aging on Facebook. You can listen to previous Seekers of Meaning podcasts by going to that page and our website, JewishSacredAging.com. And it's with great pleasure that we welcome to today's edition of Seekers of Meaning, Dr. Jeff Spiest, Associate Medical Director for the Hospice of Western Reserve, otherwise known as, if I'm not mistaken, Cleveland, Greater Cleveland. Dr. Spiest, how are you? Nice to see you.
I'm well, and greetings from the North Coast here, cloudy day, yes.
Yes, well, we're recording this in December, and in hello from southern New Jersey, where it is also cloudy and too chilly for human habitation. We're going to be discussing your book, Dying with Ease, subtitled A Compassionate Guide for Making Wiser End-of-Life Decisions. So given your background, this emerges out of your whole life's work, I would imagine, correct?
It really does. It really does. My whole life's work starting, I started in hematology and medical oncology, which basically, and then this was in the mid-80s, was taking care of lots of cancer patients, and right, most of whom did not do well. My feeling was that I was taking care of these people until their end. And so I quickly became involved with a local hospice, and through my career gradually transitioned into totally dealing with end-of-life care. But you're right. This book comes out of what I learned from those experiences, and specifically what I learned from the patients and families who were going through the process. So that is really the genesis from my book, yes.
There's a wonderful quote, I think it may be from Annie Hall, I'm not sure, one of the classic 1970s movies, a Woody Allen film, where I think the title character says that he's not afraid of dying, but he just doesn't want to be there when it happens. And then... Which I kind of identify with 100%. But humor aside, or purposely, you write in the book about our fear, the fear of dying. And look, we're still, by the time this airs, we're still going to be in the pandemic. And there's so much being written about this. Could you just elaborate more what you mean? You write about this fear and what it does, and how to overcome it or deal with it. Could you just unpack that a little bit?
I can try, because I'm not sure I know the answers, but I think I know a lot of the questions anyway. I do believe there is, I don't know if it's universal, it's certainly pan-American avoidance of the idea of death. And I think it is fear. And I have a couple thoughts about that. One of them is to unpack the old American myth that this is a nation that conquered the continent, some would say raped the continent, but conquered the continent, the manifest destiny, the American exceptionalism, the pioneer spirit, the idea that we are a people that can control what happens. We have power and the ability to make things happen the way we want them to. And dying or death is not one of those things. This is very much out of our control. And I think that's a piece of why we fear it, is we don't know what to do with that. That if I can't fix it and control it, what do I do with it? How can I deal with that? I in my experience, people who are generally healthy might have a fear of dying that's really more manifested by just avoidance. I don't have to think about it, so I don't think about it. As people get closer to the end of their lives, their fears tend to become more concrete. And some of them are very simple. I'm afraid of being alone, afraid that I will smell bad and my kids won't want to visit me. I'm afraid I will have too much pain, or I'm afraid I haven't been good enough. I'm afraid my life hasn't made a difference. I'm afraid because I don't know what comes next. So I think that people often will say they have a fear of dying, or if you ask them, so what are you afraid of? I think that's a question that sometimes takes people back because they haven't really thought about it. And if you can identify what it is you are afraid of, then you can face it a little bit more effectively. It's the old, you get thrown off a horse, you get back on again by facing your fear. And that's really, I think, one of the big points of what I was trying to do with this book is to encourage people to recognize that they are mortal, that you're going to die, it's going to happen. You can't fix that. You can fix some of the things that happened before that, and to somehow make it be okay. And by normalizing it a little bit, taking some of the unfamiliarity, the foreignness away from the idea of dying, I think helps deal with the fear. As an example, and this may be a little less, but this is actually from a study that was done in oncology practices, in which it was shown that, say, for a person who has had two different treatments for their advanced lung cancer, and they're having the conversation with the oncologist about what they would like to do next, what's the choice next? And it's been shown that if the oncologist presents this with just a little bit of negative information, it makes a difference. For example, this new treatment has a 20% chance of working, versus this new treatment has a 20% chance of working, but for most people it doesn't work. Yet that may not make a difference in what choice is made then, but it does make a difference in what choice is made the next time. And I think the reason is because the person has experienced a little bit of that shock and sadness already, and that makes it a little easier the next time through. So
you write in the book about the power of communication, and you're alluding to it here about the necessity, I guess, of real open, transparent communication between patients, families, physicians, et cetera, et cetera. But and you keep hearing these stories of, well, somebody comes in, they only have 10 minutes to discuss this, or time, or there's a hospitalist in the hospital, not my regular doctor. And I mean, exacerbated, of course, by the pandemic. And, you know, can you talk a little bit about why it is so important to have these patient physician open, transparent communications, especially as life begins to ebb?
I think it's absolutely vital. And you're right, you have hit on our medical system is great for handling disease, maybe not for handling COVID, but for handling disease, illness. The technological wonders are amazing. And we've created a good system. And the paradigm seems to be that the system takes care of the person now, rather than the competent, caring physician. So I do think that's correct. A lot of these conversations have been delegated in the hospital setting to social workers, or perhaps to a palliative care service. where the docs or nurse practitioners are trained to have these conversations. But the time to have these conversations isn't when you're sick. It's not when you're in the hospital. The best time to have these conversations is at a time when the pressure's not on. And some of those conversations should happen in the primary care office. That's one thing that I think that has happened in the last few years that is good in the medical system is Medicare now has realized that having a conversation about advanced directives, do you have your living will, do you have your durable power of attorney for healthcare, is now a reimbursable procedure like, you know, a heart catheterization, so that this encourages docs to actually have the conversations. I don't know if they do it or not, but it is open. I mean, the key is openness, and you can make those conversations happen in 10 minutes. It's a little tricky, but you can make them happen in 10 minutes if you have the open relationship with between the patient and the physician established ahead of time, because the first piece is knowing for the doc is to know who the patient is and what their values are in order to know how to have that conversation. I think it's absolutely vital to have these conversations and I don't know how you get past the fact that there's all kinds of walls up there that nobody in the room wants to have the talk. The doc doesn't really want to, and the patient doesn't really want to, and the family doesn't really want to, but they know they need to. And to get past that, I guess I've written a lot about it and don't have a short elevator speech answer. One thing that I think would help is if everybody in that room realizes that we're all in this together. I use the example. One reason I believe that physicians are not really, traditionally anyway, have not been really good at having these conversations is because they're threatening to themselves. It's been noted for a long time that a lot of physicians see dying as an enemy, as a failure. But I think there's more to it than that. I think it's actually also personally threatening, because if I'm talking about this person dying, somehow in the back of my mind, I have to realize, well, this is me too. You know, this person, me in the white coat, is also going to die. And I think if you realize that, you can have a more honest conversation because it's less threatening to everybody in the room. The tension goes down and you can actually get to what matters, which is really what the values of the person are and how to honor those values and the choices you make.
I've had some experience and there's a colleague of yours who writes sometimes for our website, Dr. Freeman here at Jefferson in Philly.
Yes. And he's great.
He teaches. He teaches at the medical school for medical students on a lot of the Rachel Naomi Remen spirituality.
Okay.
Having medical students begin to do exactly what you're talking about and encounter their own fears of death, dying, spirituality, and stuff like that. And my sense is from the work that we do in Jewish Sacred Aging, that these teachings are slowly but surely bubbling in through medical training. Is that your experience and with the idea of changing future doctors handle this?
I think it is. I do think it is. And I'm thrilled. I'm sorry. I was thinking of another Dr. Freeman who writes extensively about this, but I guess she's on the West Coast, but that's okay. You're right. I think it is that it is percolating. I think that the academic world, both whether it's in medical education or even the subspecialty societies, the American Society of Clinical Oncology, for example, has become kind of a leader in encouraging the oncology world to learn how to have these encounters in a better way. And eventually that I think percolates into the physician-patient interaction, as long as we can keep having physicians and patients meeting together. Yes, I think it is happening. I think it's a positive sign.
We're speaking again with Dr. Jeff Spiess, Associate Medical Director, the Hospice of Western Reserve, based in Northern Ohio. This book, Dying with Ease, the subtitle is A Compassionate Guide for Making Wiser End-of-Life Decisions, obviously available through the great God Amazon with a click. You, in the back of the book, that little bio blurb there talks about your interest in theology. So I would be remiss as a rabbi just asking you, where is this interest in theology and faith meandering through your own life, work, and the book? And how important is faith in these conversations? That's an easy question.
Well, yes, the easy question is it's essential, but that's, I don't, the, you know, it's interesting, and I'm talking with you and thinking, because right now I'm working on a second book, which is really looking a little more at the intersection between spirituality and dying, because I am convinced that that's a huge part of the suffering that happens for a lot of people, but trying to unpack that in my own mind. I do believe that the one's relationship with the transcendent can be a tremendous source of solace and comfort, but can also be a tremendous source of pain if it's not a healthy one. I quote in the book, and also I think it's so interesting to me. I grew up in a fairly conservative evangelical Christian congregation. That's where I come from. It's not where I am now, but it's where I come from. And as I look back on that, it was a lot of do's and don'ts, and this is how you know someone's a good person of faith, is by how well they obey the rules. And it turns out that people with that mindset, when they get to the ends of their lives, tend to make choices that surprised me. I looked at the old people in the congregation, the little ladies who read their Bibles every day and everything like that, and thinking of them as being the people who would be most at peace at the end of their lives and would be happy to just lay down in the arms of God. As it turns out, people with that religious tradition tend to choose more aggressive care and tend to go into hospice less often, tend to accept spiritual care from the hospice chaplains less often. And the hospice chaplains that I talk to say that they tend to suffer the most at the end of life, because if you have all the certain answers, you can't ask questions. And when you're dying, there's lots of questions. And if the answers don't fit, if the answers you've learned don't fit, that can be a scary and painful thing. And that's what informs why I think there needs to be more work done in that realm, so that we understand what's happening better.
Yeah. Our also experience now, because we do a lot of work in this in our program of Jewish Sacred Aging with congregations, that we're picking up a gradual, and maybe it's a little bit because of the pandemic, I don't know, but more of an embrace and an openness to having these conversations from a variety of different perspectives, even the I don't believe in anything supernatural, but whatever, fill in the appropriate blanks, but the need to have this conversation as part of the process. You write about this, I have to ask you about this. In the beginning of the book, in approaching the whole conversation about, you know, as you call it, dying with ease, this riff on the TV show Family Feud. Okay. So when I read that, I heard, wait a minute, what is, you know, what are the top five, you know, with the click? You could see the clicking of the thing on the TV.
Yeah.
Why is that in the book about dying with ease and the Family Feud?
Well, it was an exercise I used, and it comes from an article that was published 20 years ago, and that I thought made a point. And what I was trying to do is to make a particular point, and maybe it got lost in all the Family Feud.
No.
So this was Anyway, so this was an article, a study that was done, as I said, about 20 years ago, in which investigators basically give a menu of choices of things that that would make for a good diet, that would make what are the characteristics of a good end of life. And there were things like, you know, the obvious things like being free of pain, maintaining a sense of humor, having my family close to me. There were 100 or so choices. And they gave this to patients, to cancer patients who were seriously ill, nearing the ends of their lives, their oncologists, and also nurses taking care of them. And then the study was designed to kind of compare, you know, who thought what was most important. But I just loved when I looked at this list of things that were ranked by the patients as most important in the end of life, that some of them seemed counterintuitive because the docs and the nurses didn't pick them. Their caregivers didn't recognize it. So, you know, things like being free of pain didn't make the top five concerns of the patient. And I would have thought that would be number one as a physician, because that's what I do. I, you know, try and relieve pain. But things like having a nurse that you can talk to was very important. Knowing what was going to happen was very important. And I did it as a Family Feud format because it was kind of a fun teaching tool. You'd get a team of hospice folks together and say, okay, who can pick number seven, number four, whatever. And only once did anyone pick number one. The number one characteristic of quality of life at the end of life is to be clean. And it is so obvious, but nobody ever gets it. And the point that I make it is, if we want to design care plans or care systems for working with people at the end of life, we need to know what's important to them. And the only way we know what's important to them is to listen to them. And it's so obvious to know, no, I don't want to live, I don't want to die in a dirty diaper. I get that. As soon as I see it, I get it. But I think the point is, if we want to do better for the dying, we need to listen to the dying and let them tell us what's important for the end of their lives. Yeah.
It's interesting because it always goes back. That's why I wanted to ask you about that thing about communication, because it really does go back, doesn't it, to having the time and the sensitivity and the openness to sit down and say, you know, what are the questions that we need to ask you? What do you want? How do you feel? Whether it's, you know, cleanliness or pain or your faith or everything, as opposed to just, you know, checking off boxes and,
right.
You know, there was a webinar that I was on recently for another organization that we're involved with called Goals of Care in New Jersey. And they were talking about the need to restructure the conversations for between end of life to really just living. To change the emphasis. In other words, what I'm hearing you say also is, look, you're alive. Up until the last moment, you're alive. How do you want to be? What do you want? And I always remember the four questions that Gawande writes about in Being Mortal, you know, about what you're willing to do, what you're willing to trade off and stuff like this. All of this seems to be rolling through this small revolution, or maybe it's a larger revolution, of confronting the reality of our own mortality. I don't know how much the pandemic has had to do with this, but whatever it is, it seems to be working a little bit. But I have to ask you that, is this working on a certain socioeconomic level? Or are these conversations, awarenesses, communications not fully realized by all socioeconomic, racial populations of the United States of America? I have this horrible fear that, like much of this stuff, it's limited to a certain level of the country. What's your experience?
Wow, that is a gigantic question, and I think the answer is I don't know. There is no doubt that there is a historical there's a historical disconnect between what happens in several. Well, let me answer that a little differently. There, if I go back to some work that a tremendous Doc Richard Payne did several years ago, looking at the African American experience with regard to the care near the end of life, and that until you can get past the issue of trusting the system, I don't know how you have these conversations. And that isn't solved yet. There is no way that's adequately addressed. And to not get too political on it, I think things might be worse than they were a few years ago about the ability of certain ethnicities to trust that the system is going to take care of them well. So I do have the same fear. I do have the same fear. I can only deal with the patient that's in front of me and try and do that well. But I know that sometimes I've got a history to fight against or to fight through. I do think there are ways to get there, though, and that is to focus on the patient. Some things that you were talking about with regard to having the conversations be about living, not about the end of life. One of the best questions I learned for in working with a patient and family at the end of life. So for the last 5 years or so of my practice, I was the medical director of an inpatient hospice unit. So we'd get a lot of patients who were unresponsive, you know, very close to the end of their lives. And so a lot of the conversations were with families. And I learned a brilliant question, and a lot of them had come out of the hospital directly to our unit. And I started asking people, so tell me about mom. Tell me about your mom. Well, the first answer was, well, what do you want to know? Didn't you read the medical records? I mean, she's got breast cancer. And says, no. Tell me about your mother. And that was informative because I learned what I wanted to know, which is what's important to them and how can I serve them. But that also opened up the opportunity for communication, realizing this isn't about the disease anymore. This isn't about what her ejection fraction is or what her cancer is doing or what her white blood count is. This is about my mother and her life and what's important to her. So that opened up the conversations for the social worker, for the spiritual care provider. And I just loved the conversations that happened because that's what fed me, is what to finding out, to encountering these people at this human level. And, you know, if I leave the room and I've got a few tears, then I know that we've gotten somewhere and I can do some good. And this is good, yeah.
You're right.
That didn't answer your question at all, but I do have the same fear that you have, yes.
On the contrary, it's a very beautiful answer because it reminds people that there's a system of the human being. It's yeah. It's not a collection of cancer cells. It is a human being with a history and hopes and fears and joys. And all of that has to go into how you make decisions. And right. I think that, you know, like you're talking about and you write about, the more we do that, the more humane that encounter, and it does go back to what we talked about at the beginning, this idea of communication, which is a sacred task. I mean, it really is a sacred, and that's why, you know, it's another conversation, why so many people rely on family members to be their advocate and, you know, just so that people know that this is a human being here. It's not a, right. It's not a collection of cells or whatever. There's a history. You write in the book in a chapter on suffering, and you quote Freud, who you know says how long must I continue to suffer such intolerable pain? When will I be permitted to accept sweet peace, or even ask for it? And then you have another quote later on from Dostoevsky about I think control, which leads us into you know, as you started out, this myth, the American myth of control, we have a huge, great prayer in our High Holiday liturgy called the Unetane Tokef, which not so subtly reminds people that in the end, you really don't control much about life at all. Which leads to a question, really. We live in New Jersey. I live in New Jersey. We now have, for the last year and a half, the medical aid in dying bill. You write about the medical aid in dying. You put it in this context, I think, around the chapter on suffering. This is a growing phenomenon. All of Canada, we have 10 jurisdictions in the United States. God knows how many states have bills, you know, flowing through various legislatures. Where do you think this is the way of the future? Do you think this is allowing for more individuals to have a say in their own life, even as their life ends? Or is this a dangerous, slippery slope?
I think it is a way of the future. I don't know how it plays out, but I think that the desire for autonomy and freedom and further choice will. I believe that the number of jurisdictions will expand. I don't see it as a slippery slope because it hasn't proved to be. The Oregon experience shows us that in over two decades or two and a half decades now, their numbers aren't changing. You know, there's a few people who take advantage of it, but it's not turned into a slippery slope, and it hasn't opened up the floodgates of people knocking off grandmas and things like that. I am not afraid of it. I tried in my book to make it a middle of the road writing, but as a person, as a physician, I have encountered situations in which I live in Ohio, and that is not a medical aid in dying state. And I have certainly encountered patients and families who would have taken advantage of that had it been an option, and I would have thought it was a wise and choice consistent with who they were to have done that. And I've felt there was suffering that happened that wouldn't have in a different situation. So that's where I come down. You know, my passion in being a hospice doc was relief of suffering. And whatever is the right way for that patient is, you know, was what needed to happen.
And I think that what you're also alluding to, that every patient is different. Every human being is different. Absolutely. They bring unique life experiences. And I think, I guess, my opinion when I'm talking to families, you really can't make a blanket statement about this is right or this is wrong, because what's right for person A may be totally based upon that communication and that life history. You write a little bit. I got to ask you before we start running out of time. One of the great books, but you raise the issue of this very interesting literary character, Ivan Ilyich.
Yeah.
Okay, talk to me about his role in your book.
You know, Ivan Ilyich, I've read this a few times. It's a little novella by Tolstoy. You can read it in one sitting. And I think it's brilliantly written by someone who hadn't died. You know, Tolstoy hadn't died yet when he wrote this, but it takes a person. You never really know what's wrong with sees a bunch of doctors and gets lots of cockamamie ideas about what's wrong. But in through this whole time, it's told through the story is told through his eyes as he encounters the physicians, as he encounters his family, as he gets ignored, as they don't ask him the right questions, as he is a person here, becomes more and more alone because nobody's willing to encounter him as the human being that he is. And I think it's a brilliant little piece of writing. And it's kind of devastating because it's not a happily ever after story, but I think it's brutally honest. And I think it's a brilliant piece of understanding what it's like to be a dying person. So that's, I every so often I go back and reread, pull that little volume of Tolstoy off my deck just to remind myself what I'm doing here. Yeah.
Oh, no, it's a brilliant, I when I was teaching one of these classes, I assigned the story because it is like, you don't have, it's not a Russian novel that takes 5,000 pages and with 90 million names and you get lost by page four. But it is, you're right. You can sit down in one sitting and read through it. And it's just, when you read it, it's like, oh my God, what's happening to this poor man?
Yes.
You talk a little bit about it in the end, this idea of meaning, the end of your book. You have this very interesting quote: "Everything we have looked at has declared the same message. Death may be nothing, but life is everything. And to make life complete, the one living the life must continue living until the end. Knowing that we will die can instruct us in how to live well, and living well increases the likelihood of dying well." Again, it's sort of like, again, the emphasis on you're living, you're alive, live life to the fullest. That's going to bring meaning even to the end of your life. Would that be a satisfactory summary of what that message is?
I think it's exactly right. I think it's exactly right. The number of patients who told me either verbally or through actions and choices that learning how to die taught them how to live. And were kind of sad that they were only learning these lessons, when at the very end of their lives. And they were different for each person, but I think you're right. That's true with it. As I read them, some of the faith traditions, one of the books I read recently was Sangyal Rinpoche's Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. It goes through a lot of meditative practice, a lot of theory, a lot of Buddhist reincarnational theory and the bardos and things like that. But the basic point was that how one lives one's life now, it's not about the death thing. The death thing happens. Whatever happens after that isn't my business right now. But living my life is my business, and it's what I can do. I guess you said it better. I just said it longer. But I think but you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right.
Dr. Spies, can you teach this? Can you teach this to people who are not going through this experience? Could you teach this in an adult education class in a church or synagogue or in a college classroom on, medical ethics? Is it possible to really understand this idea of meaning of death through the meaning of living to people who are not beginning this journey?
Boy, that's a good question. I've tried. Because I've learned it in lecture series, the exercise that I include in the chapter, "What Does It Feel Like to Die," is I've used that in lecture formats because it was used. So I learned it in a lecture format because I think the way you teach it is to teach, to draw people into encountering themselves and their own feelings. I think it must be very hard to teach this as an objective philosophical lesson. You can get at that perhaps by reading some of the books like Ivan Illich or like Socrates' Apology or some of the classics of when people talk about the meaning. But that's all intellectual. I think you have to understand it. It has to be down here. It has to be heart knowledge. And I think that the way you teach that is through experiential teaching rather than, lecture formatted facts. It's drawing the person to encounter their own emotions and think what this might be like for themselves as a person, and realize what's important to themselves I think you have to be able to do that before you can understand how to get at that in somebody else.
Well, thank you. Dr. Jeff Spies, the author of Dying with Ease, subtitled A Compassionate Guide for Making Wiser End-of-Life Decisions. Thank you very much for your time, your compassion, your expertise, and I wish you just health and safety and joy and peace. And thank you for being with us on today's edition of Secrets of Meaning. Take care. Thank you very, very much, Doctor. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. It's been a delight.
And to all of you, thank you again for watching and listening to today's edition of Secrets of Meaning, the TV show and podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. Remember, the show is now available as a TV podcast on the Roku streaming service. Just visit bit.ly/JSAROKU. That should be easy to follow us on Roku. And again, we welcome your comments and suggestions, which you can mail to me, rabbi@jewishsacredaging.com. Again, we invite you to visit our Jewish Sacred Aging Facebook page. And if you'd like to make a tax-free donation to help support our work, please visit the jewishsacredaging.com website and click on the donate button. Secrets of Meaning is produced by the Broadcast Center at Lubetkin Media Companies in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And a big thank you and shout out to our producer, Steve Lubetkin. I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Address. I look forward to greeting you and seeing you on our next Secrets of Meaning show and podcast. Take care. Stay safe. Shalom.